From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a family had a difficult conversation about caregiving. A local mother who was in her 80s had been caring for her nonverbal daughter since she was an infant. Now her daughter was in her 50s, and the family had begun to discuss respite programs to give both women a change of pace and a break from day-to-day caregiving routines. The mother expressed resistance to enrolling her daughter in a respite program. Her other daughter said her mother never said it out loud, but she knew her mother felt guilty about a non-family member providing care. It's a conversation many families have when it comes to caregiving for people with special health needs or disabilities. According to the NAC and the AARP, in 2009, 81% of family caregivers of children with special health care needs do not use respite programs. Respite programs provide a variety of short-term temporary services that allow family members to take a break from the day-to-day schedule. And while the programs have benefits, many people who use them say they can be difficult to access and navigating the system is complicated. Our guests discuss their experience with respite programs, and we talk about how to make them more easily accessible for families. I'd like to welcome our guests in studio as a disability rights advocate. Along with, a rights advocate, Stephanie Woodward, can we mention the .com part of this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, disabilitydetails.com.
That's me.
You wear so many hats in this community. I wanted to give you the right hat today.
That's me today.
It's great to have you back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Joe Abbott is here, Vice President of Operations and COO at Epilepsy Prelude. Joe, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Hello to Dana Wells, Community Services Supervisor at Epilepsy Prelude. Thanks for being here.
Happy to.
And Tia Guthrie is Manager of Waiver Services at CP Rochester. Tia, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
This is a part of our ongoing dialogue on disability. It's a partnership between WXXI and the Al Siegel Community of Agencies. We've been doing this for a number of years now, and we've got multiple conversations this week here in January as we talk about a range of issues affecting our community and, frankly, affecting just about every family in Rochester. So before we even kind of dive into the subject of respite care, I want to kind of ask you a question, Stephanie, because one of the reasons we wanted to reach out to you was there was a conversation that came up in my mind that really sort of kind of seared into me. And it was after a tragic story out of Fairport in which a woman was killed, murdered by her father, who had been caregiving for 27 years. And some of the rhetoric in the community after then was, boy, that's a horrible tragedy. That's murder. And then there was this but, you know, burnout, but people can be tired, et cetera. And you had no patience for that, I think it's fair to say. And so what I wanted to start with, the reason I want to start with you is I think it's important to kind of erase a word which might be burden, the notion of caring as a burden, as opposed to everyone needs sort of an ebb and flow of work, of break, but burden is a word I think I hear a lot, whether it's in the tragic circumstances, which are thankfully rare, but also in day-to-day, and I wonder how you feel about that word.
I think that you are spot on with my feeling about this. I have absolutely no patience for viewing disabled people as burdens. We are not burdens. We're not burdens on our family, and we're not burdens on society. And viewing us as such means that our society still has a long way to go in viewing disabled people as equal parts of our community and just as valuable to society as anyone else. I do think that everyone needs a break, including the people with disabilities who are receiving services and care from family members or anyone else. And I think that that is why it's really important to look beyond just family members for receiving services and care, because just as much as a caregiver can get burnt out, a person receiving care from their family can get burnt out. And that's why it's really important to look beyond just your family to receive support, because you can receive support from other people and really get beyond just your own home and get out into the community. And you can receive that from other individuals in your own family, in the community, from agencies. And it can be part of your own choice rather than just your family.
I think I wanted to start with this word burden for a couple of different reasons. And I'm glad you touch on that, because number one, stigma that can be attached to disability as burden is already its own problem, for the reasons, some of the reasons we've already talked about in previous programs. But also this idea, the story of, for example, this mother who's now in her 80s, scared that, well, if I take a break, that this, I don't want to make it seem like my child is a burden, as if the notion of just any respite at all indicates that you view the work as a burden. I need a break from XXI sometimes. I get burned out on hosting the show. I love all of you guys, but I get burned out. That doesn't mean the show is a burden. I mean, there's sort of an ebb and flow to work. There's an ebb and flow to daily tasks, and everybody needs sort of a breakup of routine. But it doesn't indicate that if you need respite or if you choose respite, that what you're declaring is that the work is a burden. Is that fair?
Absolutely. But naturally, we feel a sense of guilt when we need help. And so we can also portray that on others. When another person needs help, we kind of push that guilt onto them for needing that help. Mm-hmm. And that's part of ableism. And that's where a lot of people feel internalized ableism. I think I've told you this story, and I've told the story to a lot of people. I have told my brother once, I need to hang this picture. I'm really sorry. I would do it myself if I could, but because I use a wheelchair, I just can't do it. And he looked at me and he said, no, you wouldn't. Like, if you could hang this picture yourself, you wouldn't. You would still ask me to do it. Like, I don't know why you're apologizing. Like, this is just not something you would do. Like, Stephanie, this is, you're not a picture hanging kind of girl. And I realized, like, no, I still would ask for help hanging this picture even if I could. So I don't know why I was feeling guilty about asking for help when we all ask for help sometimes, whether it's a task we can't do or we just don't want to. Lots of people ask for help when it's a task they don't know how to or they just don't want to do.
And I'll put a pin in this because we'll return to this. We're going to talk about caregivers, but also people receiving care and needing respite as well, which is an important distinction. Joe, let's just kind of start with a broad look at some of the work you do with Epilepsy Prelude. And let's kind of start broad. What do you want the community to know about what Epilepsy Prelude does, especially when it comes to respite?
Sure. Epilepsy Prelude provides a variety of services for people with all sorts of disabilities. In particular, with respite, we have after-school respite. We also have in-home respite for people that, you know, stay home and have a caregiver come into their home, and so that their parents or caregivers can go out and do different things. Our after-school program, students get bused in from their schools and receive services in a small group setting, and also allows parents to be able to work. You know, a lot of parents out there have to work till 5-6 o'clock in the evening, and school gets out 3 o'clock. And, you know, so there needs to be a place for these kids to go, young adults and kids, and to be safe and also be able to be productive and get things done, and most importantly for their parents to feel safe that their child with a disability is in a safe place and that they're being well taken care of and they're with people that know how to act and interact with their children.
You've worked for a number of service agencies throughout your career. How do you see the state of respite programs in the area generally, and do you think it's been changing?
I definitely think there's more opportunities now than there used to be. I think it's a huge need in the community. You know, like I had mentioned before, especially with the working parents who have children with disabilities. You know, a lot of times it's hard to find a safe place or people that know how to interact with their children, that are specially trained to work with them. And then also know that when you're working with an agency, that the staff have been vetted, that they are going to be safe in that location. A lot of times, you know, parents of children with disabilities, there's a big fear about having someone else watch their kids or be with their kids. And, you know, and there's more opportunities now than there used to be, but it is still, there's still a lot of challenges. It's difficult, as depending on the level of disability a person may have.
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of pushing into an area that I wanted to make sure I understand as well as we can, which is to the extent that people who might, you know, be categorically, thinking about respite, but don't, which is a big probably proportion of caregivers. Why is that? And you're indicating that at least one of the reasons is this hesitation, even for short amounts of time, to put care in someone else's responsibility.
Yeah.
But are there other reasons? I mean, would you say that's the main reason? Sometimes is it that people don't know what's available in the community?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of things. And yeah, getting the information out there, getting the knowledge of what services are available to people, making sure that they fully understand what is available and what the process is to access the service. I think there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. Some of these services are not the easiest to access. There's, you know, eligibility requirements and, you know, geographical requirements, you know, especially when we talk after school, you know, if you're busing, schools don't always bus to the, if it's a location that's outside of the district, then transportation becomes an issue. So there's a lot of barriers that you have to overcome, but I think once they're in, they are, the kids, they love the service, and mm-hmm. I think the parents, you know, it does give them the opportunity to be able to live their lives as well, do the things that they need to do, work, you know, and do errands after work, and then pick up their kids and take over from there.
Dana, can you tell us a little bit about the work you do as community service supervisor?
Sure. I go out and meet new families pretty regularly. I talk about the program, give them opportunities to ask any questions that they might have. And then I take the information that I learn from them and from their children and bring it to our intake committee, who then reviews it and gets them set up, give them the opportunity to share their needs and wants and what they might see in a staff that they're looking for, and find them a staff that we can provide that both the parents and the children are comfortable with and feel like that's somebody that they would want to be spending time with, whether it be at home or their staff for the after-school program as well.
What's an example of a story, without naming names, that illustrates the system working the way you think it should work? I mean, are there people who use the services who kind of come to mind?
Absolutely, yeah. We have a variety of mostly children, but adults can also be part of the program. Mostly, you know, we have ages all the way from 4 up until 20, 21. Mm-hmm. Typically, like Joe said, it's families who need a little bit of support after school or maybe on the weekends.
Okay. Tia, why don't you tell us about what CP Rochester's role in this part of the community is?
Yeah, you know, we're similar to EPI Prelid. We offer respite services, a variety of services to individuals with a variety of disabilities. We also have an after-school program, our wraparound program, and we provide in-home respite. We have a freestanding respite house, and then we also have recreational respite services and a summer rec respite program.
Okay. How do you see it working or sometimes not working the way it's intended?
You know, there's different stories, different outcomes, depending on the individual's needs. We touched on transportation, some of those barriers that you guys see at EPI Prelid. We see those as well. We try our best to meet everybody's needs, but sometimes we fall short with transportation or the system. If it, you know, takes a family a while to get through the system, sometimes they lose the steam or they become frustrated, and we try our best to help them from our end with what we can do to navigate the system and get the services that they need. We do have individuals who cross over services once they get through the system. They might use our wraparound respite as well as in-home respite, and then often they'll attend our summer rec respite program too. So once we can get them through, we can help them in a variety of ways, but it can be frustrating sometimes trying to get through all those barriers.
Sure. Stephanie, as a disability rights advocate with, again, disabilitydetails.com, what's your overview of how the community is doing in this area?
I think that we can do a lot better. I think that it's very different for parents of children with disabilities to learn about respite versus children with parents with disabilities who need to learn about respite. Learning about respite when you have kids with disabilities, you can learn about it from the school district. There's more paths to learning about it, whereas when you have a parent who is aging, sometimes you start caring for them in a very informal way that becomes more frequent. And then you're helping mom occasionally, and then mom moves in, and then you don't realize that there is a way to get mom attendant services in your home. So you kind of just take care of mom because you don't want to go to a nursing home. And you don't realize that there are other ways to get help, and you don't know where to look to just take a break. So finding information about, is respite care available? Does insurance cover? Is that something I have to pay for? It can be really scary for families. And we don't have a lot of information out there for families who may not be encountering the need for respite at a young age, but maybe midlife or older? And it can be really a huge, scary part of a family's life when you're living in a budget household and not knowing that, hey, Medicaid could cover this, but is mommy, what's the difference between Medicaid and Medicare? Which one do we have? These are very hard things to figure out, and not knowing where to go to figure out how to get the right services, because sometimes it's not even respite that you need. You might be eligible for attendant services, which could be exactly what you need to get the break that you need to help mom get the services she needs so that you could go back to work.
We have a society in which people from all different backgrounds who, you know, aren't wealthy may assume get whatever their needs are in life. Well, you know, that's for rich people. That's for people with money. You know, that's not, as opposed to thinking, could this be covered? Do we have access to this? Are there ways to get that? So what are we going to do to start changing? I mean, like, what needs to happen to where that access, or at least that understanding, starts to change?
I think that having conversations like this to let people know that you can make calls, you can reach out. There are services in our community that you can ask about. Having Medicaid is, I think, looked down on, and a lot of people think like Medicaid is a poor person's program and it's bad to have, but it actually opens the door to a lot of services that can make your life a lot easier. So being able to reach out to community organizations and say, hey, how can I become eligible and what services are right for me? I'm looking for a no wrong door program to just figure out, like, okay, I called all these places and everyone's saying I'm not eligible. What am I eligible for?
You called it a no wrong door program?
Yes.
Explain.
So no wrong door means that you call and rather than just being told, nope, this isn't for you, no wrong door says, okay, what is the right path for you? So No Wrong Door was created through New York State, and a lot of different organizations have a No Wrong Door program. So rather than this idea of just shutting the door, saying, okay, well, you're not OPWDD eligible, or you're not whatever the acronym is eligible, you've told us your story. Now let's figure out what you are eligible for, and let's help you get there. So different organizations do have No Wrong Door programs. So I know right down the street at the Regional Center for Independent Living, they have a No Wrong Door program. You could call, tell them your story, and they can help you figure out what you might be eligible for and help you get there.
Okay. Who would you call first?
I would call Melanie Oyer at the Regional Center for Independent Living, but I call her for almost everything that I don't know.
Let me go around the table and ask Tia Guthrie from CP Rochester. How do people find out if there is eligibility for these various services?
Yeah, people can call the front door at OPWDD, and there are individuals there that can help people similar to our CIL or other agencies that have kind of an intake, you know, representative. They're kind of like the first point for families to call, and they can figure out which direction to go to be able to determine eligibility and access services that would meet their needs.
Okay. Joe?
I would say pretty much the same as Tia. For our programs, they are 100% OPWDD funded, so going through the front door process with OPWDD. Also, if people are interested and don't really know what their eligibility requirements are, they can call Epilepsy Prelude directly. We do have an intake department that can help lead a person to the right direction, and that may be referring them to OPWDD and calling the front door number to start that process of getting eligibility and being approved for service.
We've been talking about respite needs for caregivers. Stephanie, what about people who receive care?
I think people who receive services need just as much of a break. Could you imagine being with the same person every single day, all day long? Like, you need a break. I have a fiance. He doesn't care for me, but I need a break from him, just living with him. I go to work, and he goes to work. And
you think he needs a break from you?
I guarantee you.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
He needs a break from me.
Speaking up for the man who's not here.
Speaking for as we all know that there's like a strong personality in every relationship, but I got to say, I'm a strong personality, so that man, bless him, he needs a break from me. So we have that opportunity because we get away from each other to go to work every day. But individuals who receive services or care from their family members don't have an opportunity to get 8 hours away from them. It could be 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm. So just as much as a caregiver says, hey, I need a break because I'm doing all of this stuff for someone, that person can say, hey, I need a break. Like, you're near me all of the time. And as much as caregivers don't mean to say things, like, it could be really harmful to hear your mom or your sister say, oh, it's so much work to just take care of you all the time. Like, that could be a really harmful to hear. And just imagine being a teenage boy. If your mom is the person caring for you all of the time, mm-hmm. could you imagine the break you need if your mom is the person helping you shower, helping you get into bed? Like, if how are you going to get a date? How are you going to flirt with anybody if your mom is with you 24/7? That teenage boy needs a break too.
So before I turn to the other guests there, you're referencing something I think probably is, at least for me, it's something I don't think about much. We hear about elder abuse. We hear about abuse of people with disabilities, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, but often that sort of depicted in ways that are really overt. Whereas what you're describing is even the well-intended stuff, you know, the long sigh and the, you know, it's really hard doing this work for you, that, which isn't intended to be abusive, but it can land in a certain way and maybe build up over time, especially if there is no respite. How damaging can that be?
I think it can be incredibly damaging. We talk about ableism in our world being similar to all the other isms, sexism, racism. But internalized ableism is where you take that ableism and you start to believe it about yourself. You start to believe that you are less than others because of your disability. And when people around you start to say things that even in a little way can make you feel bad, that you have a disability and can make you feel like you're an inconvenience, you start to believe it. And you start to believe that your place in this world is an inconvenience to other people. And you start to wonder, like, well, do I belong here? And we do see that the suicide rate among people with disabilities is higher than that of people without disabilities. And I have no doubt that our rhetoric about people with disabilities contributes to that.
Mm. Tia, why don't you offer some of your thoughts about the importance of respite, not just for the caregivers?
Yeah, I think it's important for everybody to get a balance. Whether you have a family member, a friend, a child, a significant other with a disability or without a disability, you know, we all have to have an even balance of being with that person and without that person for our wellness, our mental health, you know, to be able to be a solid family unit or to be able to give to one another, you know, the best as we can. We have to have those breaks here and there.
Okay. Dana, what do you think?
I agree. Absolutely. I think both the caregiver and the kids need a break. I'm a parent and I know, you know, my kids don't want to hear it from mom sometimes. Sometimes they need somebody else to kind of chime in and give them some direction as well. And they tend to be more likely to find the fun in it versus it being a chore if it's coming from somebody else or another peer at the program encouraging them to do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I also think, you know, from the perspective of the person receiving the service, I think, you know, the relationships that are built in respite, the social aspect, the friendship aspect, whether it be, you know, an hourly program or even an overnight freestanding respite, I can tell there's been a lot of kids that I've worked with or young adults that I've worked with that really enjoy going, and they look at it as something that they really want to do. And then on the, you know, on the other side of the coin is the parents really can start to realize and learn that, you know, that their children or young adults will be okay if they're not living with them 100% of the time or that they have to stay with them 24/7. You know, sometimes it's a good first step for those young adults or to take a step out of the house and make sure that, you know, it's a nice ease into more independent living without the parents there. So I definitely see it as a really good learning opportunity, both socially for the person receiving service, as well as the parents, really understanding that their child, whether they be, you know, a minor or a young adult, or even, you know, an older adult, will be okay and living away from them. And I think that's a huge important lesson for parents and, you know, people receiving services to learn.
Let me grab a phone call from Bonnie, who's been listening in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Respite, from my experience, is probably one of the most important services that you can have. After the Willowbrook consent decree, a lot of these services started to be much more valued, and of course, it takes time to expand them. But respite, I can't say enough about it. It's just incredibly valuable. And the person I don't remember their names, of the person who just spoke. You know, the whole idea of respite has many pieces to it. It's to give people a break. It's also to give the person with a disability a chance to see the rest of the world. And as you go along in time, one of the best things to do is to do it over time, so that as the person gets older, they have other experiences, and it's not a shock like, oh, well, I've never had an experience away from my family. That can be a really tough thing for people. If you haven't had any, shall we say, practice with it. The other thing I wanted to talk about, though, is that a few minutes ago we were talking about figuring out eligibility. You know, to me, and I'm going to use strong language here, it is a disgrace what the state of New York did when they got rid of one of these services that provided and required that there be service coordinators for every single family, unless, you know, nobody's going to force you. But that was their job, among other things, was to look around, you know, help the family, you know, differentiate, well, this service may be better than that service. This is a funding, that's a funding. I'll give you a quick example. I work with a family who was mother and father, and they had a son who had a significant disability, and they moved to California for a while. And when they moved back, I talked to her, and she was very energetic and really a good mom, and she said, Bonnie, when I went to California, they gave me a booklet. It was more like a book with hundreds and hundreds of places to go to see. She said, I thought I was going to go crazy. I couldn't do all that. I don't know. I didn't know anybody. I don't want to spend half my life going. So that gives you an example of, and that, you know, California is not a poor state. Of how important these things are, they're stressing, the stress, the constant. And she said, I'm so glad I came back to New York. And that's not to say New York is a perfect place or anything like that, because, as I said, the governor did away with a lot of these services that were required, and some of them were paid by the state, some of them were federal, but they were critical services to help people have that kind of help in getting directed, so you don't have to figure out, you know, is it Medicare, is it Medicaid, all that kind of stuff that just should not have to be a burden to people, because it is, can be complicated and just stressful, and who needs more stress? So I wonder, and right now, it sounds like not everyone has the opportunity to have a service coordinator if you want it. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Bonnie. So service coordination. I guess you want to weigh in on that?
This is Stephanie. I think that Bonnie, I would agree with Bonnie that there is a problem with switching. New York State did switch to what we call care coordination over service coordinators. Service coordinators did have much smaller caseloads, and care coordinators are more connected to what we call managed care organizations. So it's a bit more complex than I think we could cover in 3 seconds. But I will say that I think service coordinators were less biased in the services that they were providing and had much smaller caseloads, so they were able to provide more in-depth and better services to individuals. And the switch to care coordination has been a hard one for many individuals.
Want to endorse that or add to that? Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah. You know, I think Stephanie's absolutely right. I think that, you know, New York State continues to be in a transition from service coordination to care coordination. And right now, you know, it was a huge learning curve for those employees that were once service coordinators who are now care coordinators, and learning their new job and all the new paperwork It's been over a year, and it's still, I think the families and the people receiving services are still feeling that transition and the difficultness behind that.
Okay. Well, let's take our only break of the hour. When we come back, we're going to meet Patsy, who is a mom whose teenager attends Epilepsy Prelude's after-school respite and recreational respite programs. And we're talking about what is available, how to know what is out there, how to access it, who is eligible, and the importance of respite care for caregivers and for people receiving care. I mean, this is not just about the caregivers. Our panel is talking about that. You just heard Joe Abbott, Vice President of Operations and COO at Epilepsy Prelude, and Dana Wells is here, Community Services Supervisor there. Tia Guthrie is Manager of Waiver Services at CP Rochester. Stephanie Woodward, a disability rights advocate with DisabilityDetails.com. We're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour on WXXI, you will hear impeachment trial coverage from the Senate, live coverage from NPR National. And on WRUR, a previously recorded conversation in which we sat down with two women who have been an important part of the journalism scene in Rochester for many years, Len B. and Duty Hofer and Norma Holland, talking about the changes in their careers and how they see the work in journalism. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I want to welcome Patsy to the program, who is Hassan's mother, who is a teenager. How are you doing, by the way? Thanks for being here, Patsy.
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Tell me about Hassan.
Well, Hassan is a bright, vibrant young man who has been receiving services all of his life, and I've been accessing various programs for him through what was service coordination, but now prime care or care coordination. And he's been in the respite programs through CP Rochester and EPI for several years now. So,
and he's pretty, a teenager now?
He's 18 years old now.
18?
Yes, he is. And I think we first started with the respite programs when he was probably around 10 or 11.
How's he doing now?
He's doing wonderful. Mm-hmm. He attends the transition program through BOCES, Monroe BOCES number 2. And after he leaves work and school, he attends the the respite programs until about 7:30, and then he comes home at night.
You've been listening to this conversation about respite.
Yes.
For people in a lot of different parts of our community, whether it's caregivers, people receiving care. What do you want listeners to know about the reality for caregivers and for teenagers like Hassan when it comes to respite and those kind of needs?
What I would really like to stress is that, first of all, Hassan is my only child, and it took a lot for me to let go of every single thing that had to have anything to do with Hassan. I wanted to do the caregiving. I wanted to do the respite. I wanted to be his mom. I had an issue with letting go of some of the responsibilities and trusting that he would be in a program that would be safe for him, and also with staff that would understand his disabilities or his intellectual needs. Mm-hmm. So that took a minute for me to trust the program. And I find very good staff and success with EPI and CP Rochester. Hassan absolutely loves the programs. He's a social person, so he meets no strangers. Everyone is his friend, which could sometimes make me a little uneasy. That's why I like the programs with the respite agencies, because they're trained and they're knowledgeable with Hassan, and they participate in like his service coordinating meetings and know exactly what to expect or the expectations for Hassan and what he can and cannot do.
Okay. Now, when you talk about letting go, mm-hmm. is that back when he was 10, 11 years old?
Yes, or
earlier than that. It was about when he started receiving those services?
Yes, because he wasn't the type of child that would fit in really with a typical daycare setting, and he was getting older. So I was left with the choice of what do I do with him after school, because I'm a working mom, and my day doesn't end at 2 and 3 o'clock. So I was introduced to the respite programs for after school, and we started with one agency there for several years, and EPI took that agency over. And like I said, it's been very, very helpful. And I see Hassan growing in so many areas, especially socially. He even started attending the Saturday programs with his friends. And I had opportunity to see him interact with the various other peers that he's with. And it's a difference between night and day, between how he is around home and how he is with his friends.
I was writing some notes when you were talking about your concerns or what you felt about letting go. And one of the things that you said was, I wanted to be doing the care. I wanted to be doing the respite. And I thought, Patsy, you can't, I don't think you can do the respite, can you? I mean, like the break from, it's a break for you, it's a break for him. If you're doing the respite, there's not a respite, I don't think.
It's not. And it wasn't ideal, and it wasn't. I had to convince myself this was something for Hassan and put myself on the back burner. In order for Hassan to grow into the young man that he is becoming, Mom had to take a step back. And I think that was the best decision. And it gives me a break. Especially during the weekends when he's on Saturdays. As soon as he leaves on Saturdays, I get my coffee and I just sit there. And I don't worry about him, and I know he's going to come back. He had a wonderful time. Sometimes they have extended times on Saturdays and they take him different places. The summers are absolutely wonderful for him. And what I like is I overlap the services between CP Rochester and EPI. So he has a group of friends at EPI. He has a group of friends at CP Rochester. And sometimes they intertwine. And he's a very social person. And I think that has a lot to do with the exposure that he's had through respite services.
I wish listeners could see when you talked about when he goes on the weekend and you actually just get some coffee, you actually lean back in your chair.
Yes, I can relax.
You actually relax just for a moment. And from what I can see in you as a parent, you have a comfort level now. Because this is I think, such a key for caregivers, for parents, for kids with disabilities, kids who do not have known disabilities. But it's the idea that if I'm letting go and someone else is in charge, if I can trust that this, you know, that the child is safe, that it's going to go well, then maybe I can make a coffee. I might read a book.
Right.
There's amazing things that I might
actually watch my own Netflix movies. I don't have to watch, like, but Marvel stuff.
Yeah. But if you don't have that comfort, then it doesn't feel like a break. How long did it take for you to feel like this is going to be okay?
When I actually had conversations with the staff, like Dana, and I felt like they were invested. They took what I said and they saw who Hassan was, not for just his disabilities, but for the person he is. And they work with him like any other program, like he was at the Y or any other program with young adults, and talk to him in the way that I would want someone to talk to my child, not downing them or telling them, or this is what you can't do. You can't do this. Or, hey, try this. Or, oh, son, you know, do this. And, or, you know, and I communicate with the staff and they know what my expectations are. So sometimes they have to say, well, we're going to have to tell Mom about this. And Hassan straightens right up. So I like the communication and I like that they value what I say. But they have their own techniques and things to work with in order to help Hassan grow. So, and I appreciate that because it helps me. It's a learning. Every day is a learning process with Hassan, and I'm sure with any other child. But I see that the outcomes far outweigh any fears that I've had regarding respite.
Dana, what's that mean to you to hear that from her?
It's huge. It's really great. And that's what we want for parents to be able to do, is to feel that relief. And there's a lot of ways you can kind of ease into it. Some parents, if they're not quite comfortable just yet, even though, you know, we want parents to get a break, if parents want, they actually can be the staff, or grandma and grandpa can be the person's staff. You can have some say in that, and we can hire family friends or an old teacher, somebody that maybe the child already knows, and that can make it a little bit easier for the parents when they can actually do the hiring process and interview if they want to, or if they, you know, don't have somebody, that's okay too. We can provide somebody and they can meet them and go from there too.
And for you, Patsy, I mean, I know you've got, it's obvious the trust and the relationships that have grown with Hassan, staff members, the people from these organizations, the friends he's made. And, but I'm curious to know how you view the benefit to him of not only having people who are doing, really doing right by him, but also, you know, there's no doubt you're an amazing mom. I mean, we've known you for 5 minutes and you're an amazing person. The love that you have for him, I mean, just that ability of you to say, I didn't even know if I could let go because of how much you love him and how much you want him to have what's best. So knowing how great of a mom you are, how important is it for your son to see someone besides you during the day?
It's important.
Because you're awesome.
Well, thank you. But it's like I said, I'm a work in progress. We all are a work in progress. But for Hassan to get a break, and to say, it kind of normalizes his life. Mm-hmm. He is around peers that are similar to him, and they relate to each other, and they can relate to different experiences. Hassan doesn't think he has a disability, because I don't like the dis in the disability. I just say, you can do whatever Hassan feels he can do, and if you can't, if you try, it doesn't work, we'll try something else. And I think that the common theme in all of the young people that he's with is that they are just like all the same peas in one pot, and they all kind of mesh together, and they work well together. And I don't see where anyone's picking on someone or teasing anyone. And if they do, the staff is right on top and say, no, this is not something you're going to do. We all treat each other. And Hassan is a natural leader. And he likes to tell people what's right and what's wrong. And sometimes it does take the light of what he's done. So he is always accountable for, okay, so this person did this, this person did that, but Hassan, what did you do? And he has to bring it back and reel it in, and I think that it makes him more responsible. And I think he needs to break. He needs to break from home, and he needs to break from grandma, because my mom lives with me as well, and he needs a break from his mother telling him what to do. And I realize that. And the programs provide him with a break that he desperately needs.
Well, let me read an email from a listener who's kind of touching back on some of the comments made earlier in the hour. Julian writes to us to ask, it's not clear to me the difference between care coordination and service coordination, and why did New York change approaches? Also wants to know if lifespan is a source for open door policy for care coordination. Stephanie?
I'm not sure if lifespan offers open door or no wrong door, but
no wrong door, yeah.
I would strongly suggest giving them a call and finding out. We're all wondering why New York State made the change. You could certainly go to New York State's website, and they'll give you plenty of reasons. There are many differences between service coordination and care coordination. Some of the major differences that I take note of are the caseload differences. There is a significant difference. I want to say that service coordinators used to have around 20 or less in their caseload, whereas care coordinators can have about 100 on their caseload. So that's a pretty significant difference. And care coordinators can work for the managed care organization. And managed care organizations are the entities that can approve or not approve services, whereas service coordinators didn't work for the organizations that approved the services. So there was a disconnection between that bias that a care coordinator may have.
Okay, well, before the hour wraps then, we've covered a lot of ground this hour, but if we're going to sort of create a society, or at least a community here, in which Patsy's story is more of the norm, you know, a story of successful accessing of programs, a success story for Hassan. He's comfortable, you're comfortable, you're aware of what's out there, as opposed to a lot of people not being aware of what's out there, not aware what covers what. Let me ask all of you, I'll start with Stephanie Woodward. What do you want to see change in the near future that would sort of bring down some more barriers?
I want to see a lot more information out there so people know how to access services. I would like to see another show like this where people who receive respite are the people talking. I think this is a great start to the conversation, but I think that people who are receiving the services should lead the conversation, not the people who are providing it, because nothing about us without us shouldn't just be a catchphrase. It is definitely the mantra of the disability community.
I think that's very fair and well said. Tia, what do you think?
I'd agree with Stephanie. You know, a culture of constant conversation, you know, never stop talking about your needs or what you're looking for. The more that we can push out into the community and make people aware of, the better off we all will be. You know, to hear stories about Hassan and others who have received services or have had challenges receiving services, so that way we can continue to work towards making things better for everybody.
Patsy, do you think other parents and families who might be in sort of similar circumstances are as aware as you have become of what's available in this community?
I think that it's getting better as far as what's out there for families. I would suggest just talking to, even if you start with school staff, if you start with, if you have a service coordinator or a care coordinator, ask around. You can Google almost anything, and you can also call 311 if you have questions. I'm interested in advocating for kids, so I tell people if I feel like they're receptive and they want to know, hey, where does Hassan go, or what is he into? I have a child with similar needs. I tell them, and I, you know, try to give them the correct information on what steps to take in order to access services, because a lot of times people aren't as savvy in navigating through the system, and it does take a little time, but the time that it takes you to navigate it, if you are qualified for different services, it far benefits the family in the long run. And it took a while to get to where we are with Hassan, but I'm very pleased at where we are and moving forward with him.
And maybe we'll meet Hassan sometime.
Maybe. I think he would like that.
Dana, what do you want to see change?
I think the method and how people get started in it is a little bit antiquated. I think if they could maybe make it look a little bit more fun for younger kids and for even younger parents and people out there, whether they, you know, the way they get the word out there, whether it's social media or, you know, automating some of the processes, I think that would make a big difference.
Okay. Well, we once again, we've covered some ground, but if you have been listening to this hour and thinking, boy, there's maybe more out there, or I know someone who really could benefit from this, let's just talk about how to get in touch briefly. Dana, how can people get in touch?
I think email is really great. System is all based on that, and we can, you know, you can really search people very easily that way. And again, social media, we're always on there, whether it's Twitter or Instagram, we're there.
Okay. Any advice you want to share for navigating the system, Patsy?
Don't give up. Keep asking questions. If you don't get the questions answered, ask someone else until you find out and get, you know, network, meet with other parents. With the programs that are offered, there are definitely opportunities to just talk, and I think communication is the key. And don't be afraid. Don't you know, limit yourself or your child or your whoever you're taking care of. Open yourself up and try to get the information you need.
Okay, Tia?
Yeah, if people are looking for assistance with navigating the system or just learning more about services, they can certainly call 334-6000 and get in touch with CP Rochester. We'd be happy to help anybody learn more about our services and how to access OPWDD's front door and start the eligibility process.
Okay, Stephanie?
I would say definitely reach out, look for a no wrong door service. If you can't find one, you could always reach out to me at disabilitydetails.com, and I might not be the end person to help you, but I will definitely help you find the right resource for you. And be open to other resources as well. Respite might not be the only thing that's right for you. You could be eligible for other services that can be helpful too.
It's disabilitydetails.com.
That's me.
Thanks for being here, as always, Stephanie Woodward with us, and our thanks to the rest of the panel here as well. Joe Abbott joined us earlier this hour, Dana Wells as well from Epilepsy Prelude. Thank you for being here, Dana. Nice having you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Tia Guthrie, who is joining us from CP Rochester. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Patsy, continued success. Thanks for being here to share your and Hassan's story. Really appreciate having you.
Thank you so much.
Great having you. Our thanks, to the partnership with the Al Siegel Community of Agencies as we continue the dialogue on disability right here on Connections and WXXI's many platforms here throughout this week. Our thanks to Don volunteering. Emma Ray is our intern. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.